Just a reminder that today is the last lecture for the cardiovascular section. Next Monday is a holiday. It's an official K305 holiday. Call it what you want. As long as you don't call it some, name it after some queen of some foreign country, that's fine. Wednesday, Mike starts. Friday is the midterm for the cardiovascular section that covers only the last half of the cardiovascular section. There's a review session on Thursday at 4:30, July 3rd. Okay, any questions on that? Everyone comfortable? So have the MP3 files made me obsolete? So the attendance seems to go down, or is it just at 8:30 in the morning you'd rather listen to an MP3 file with a glass of scotch or something late at night? Or are they useful? Yeah? And I should be just a hologram up here and the whole thing to be virtual. Okay. So we're talking about, what were we talking about? Talking about cardiac ischemia. June 27th. This is a good day for me. My father turns 88 today. So he's doing pretty well. But you don't really care about that. We talked about contractile dysfunction. We talked about two types, reversible and irreversible. We talked about stunning. And even though this is reversible, for the period of time immediately after the ischemic insult, this is a serious problem to deal with. The most obvious example is after open heart surgery, but anytime anyone has an event, the heart is in a hypocontractile state and it could put it at risk. So it's reversible, but in one sense it's reversible, that is that if the conditions are right, it will recover from this, but the stunning itself may be of such serious consequence in terms of degree that it could result in death. So you have to sort of understand the subtle difference there. And then we talked about irreversible damage caused by lack of blood flow. And we talked about necrosis and apoptosis. And apoptosis, some of you are familiar with, very interesting pathways. Many of the enzymes, caspases, as I said, have been worked out. And this is true in cardiac muscle as well. Okay, so this is simply what I talked about on Wednesday. And this is an example. And in this case, this is a heart that's beating, and this is left ventricular pressure. And you can't see each individual beat because the time scale is relatively slow, but it's going from 0 millimeters of mercury up to about 80 with each beat. It's going up and down, up and down, up and down. And right here, we have what's called low-flow ischemia. So it's global ischemia, but it's partial, but the partiality is very high. So it's tremendous reduction in the flow down to just 1 mL a minute. And you can see what happens. This is sort of the hallmark of the contractile dysfunction, is that the beat-to-beat tension generation falls precipitously. And the beat-to-beat is represented by the difference between the bottom and the top of this line. So that falls almost instantaneously. And the second thing is diastolic dysfunction, which I talked about. And this baseline is creeping up and up and up right here. The bottom trace is showing what coronary blood flow is. So it's gone from 50 to 1. That's why this impact is so large. So the diastolic dysfunction is due to a calcium overload that we talked about and a contracture. This is what a contracture is. It's persistent. And you can see that at this point right here, this is 5 hours, that the tension developed during diastole is almost as great as the tension that's normally developed during systole. In other words, troponin C is almost completely occupied by calcium, even without excitation. This is a disaster. And then this is reperfusion, right here. Blood flow is reestablished. You can see the reactive hyperemia. Blood flow goes above the baseline. We talked about this as a metabolic regulation, and because metabolites have accumulated, supercompensation of blood flow. But you can see what's happening here, that reperfusion is causing a slight increase in the developed force, but the baseline is increased even further, and this is reperfusion injury that's been caused. This is an exaggerated case because it's 5 hours of almost complete ischemia, but it shows you the consequences. Okay? Now, just to tell you about some of the other consequences, we have definitely have a hypocontractility. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about stunning, hibernation, necrotic or apoptotic damage. This is a state of hypocontractility. The degree of hypocontractility depends on the number of cells that have been involved and the number of cells that are involved depends on the degree of block, which blood vessel is blocked. Remember I mentioned the left anterior descending, the LAD, is the widowmaker, because it subserves a large number of cells in a critical area of the heart, the left ventricular free wall. So the hypocontractility, the degree of it is affected by all those factors, and the severity of it depends on where it is and the degree. And the other part, and I don't have a lot of time to talk about this, but when the cells become damaged, it also changes their excitation. And we'll talk a little bit about this subsequently when we talk about the EKG. But it means some areas cannot conduct action potentials in a way that they normally do. And remember that the action potentials go from cell to cell, and this is critical for normal propagation. We have this kind of thing through connections, gap junctions between cells. And so when some section of the heart is in a hypocontractile state, it usually means that its excitation is also affected. It may become depolarized, may become inactive electrically. Conduction is affected. And what that means is we may have areas that are different membrane potential. We may have blocks. We talked about bundle branch blocks, for example, but other types of blocks that can produce a whole host of arrhythmias, which I can't talk about. There's literally dozens of arrhythmias that could result from this kind of scenario. And both the hypocontractility and the arrhythmias can be lethal independently or collectively. Okay, how are we doing? Any questions on that? No? Okay. All right, so this is a figure from Guyton. And it goes back to the vascular function curves and the cardiac function curves. And in this particular panel, it's showing only the cardiac function curve itself, basically a Starling curve. But it's using the abscissa of the vascular function curve, right atrial pressure. And it shows what happens to this curve after someone suffers an MI. And an MI is irreversible damage, either necrotic or apoptotic, it doesn't really matter. We go into a state of hypocontractility. And that is represented by the solid red line is the normal heart, and then subsequent to an MI, the curve moves down here. And this is a very serious state, and it's a reflection of the degree of damage, the number of heart cells that are affected, and the degree to which they're affected. But going from A to B, you can see now the cardiac output has gone from 5 liters per minute, which is normal, to something below that. And that's a serious problem. We need 5 liters per minute for a variety of reasons, including getting enough blood flow to the brain, etc. But we also need it so that we have appropriate filtration of the kidney and fluid balance. If the kidneys don't see enough fluid, they don't see enough blood. In other words, if the GFR goes down, it means that we have problems with fluid regulation, composition of blood, retention of fluids, etc. So in this particular case, this person is lucky because they go through a series of adaptations, and the one that occurs almost instantaneously is going from B to C, and this is in which the blood pressure has fallen because of the hypocontractility. Baroreceptors pick it up, sympathetic nervous system sends out a discharge from the medulla, increasing heart rate, increasing contractility. We move to this portion of the curve. And going from C to D, this may take 2 or 3 days. B to C occurs within tens of minutes, maybe sooner, maybe within minutes. C to D is a recovery of the heart, and this would reflect stunned myocardium that perhaps after 3 or 4 days is now coming back online. These cells are now functional, and we're moving up to this point D. Now at point D, we have a normal cardiac output. But don't be fooled. The cardiac output is normal at rest. But you can see that the scope of the person's cardiac output is drastically diminished. So as soon as this person tries to walk up a flight of stairs, they're going to run into some serious problems. That's the first thing. The second thing is, look at the right atrial pressure. The right atrial pressure shifted from something close to zero to about +6. And there's some certain consequences of this. So this person, they're in a steady state. And this is a good sign because they have enough cardiac output to perfuse the brain, perfuse the kidneys, perfuse the heart. So they're functional, they're alive, and their vital signs are stable. But they are no way where they were before. And going from D back up to here may never happen. It really depends on, you know, what kind of remodeling occurs after this MI. And if it's very serious, of course, the only alternative would be a transplant. Okay, now, this is something else, that's related. After an MI, so here we have the cardiac function curve and the vascular function curve, and this is a heart in which the MI was more serious, greater damage, and the cardiac output has fallen to a level, and this is several days after the MI, is still not at the appropriate level. The previous example I showed is called compensated heart failure because it makes the appropriate homeostatic adjustments to get back up to an appropriate cardiac output. We say 5 liters per minute, but of course it varies with the size of the person and all that. But whatever value, the critical value is for that person. In this example, it is not compensated. It's called decompensated, as shown here, because it does not get up to this critical level. Never does, and it goes into heart failure right here. And you can see the immediate effect is the vascular function curve goes up here because we're retaining fluid, shifts this thing upwards like this, and then goes back a few days later. That is the vascular function curve. But in this particular situation, this person is always below the critical level. And this is a beginning of heart failure and other organ failure. Now this person has been treated, and this is an unfortunate word, digitalized. What it means is they were given Wavane or digitalis. It's not a digital heart they've been given. We don't have digital hearts. It would be nice, but they don't exist. Unfortunately, I don't have time, but there are a variety of mechanical hearts that people are building right now, and you already know of some people that have been kept alive for a few weeks on mechanical hearts, but they're improving. They're getting smaller. They're getting more internalized so that you don't have to have a truck carrying around all the ancillary equipment with it. They're getting much smaller and maybe have a future. In this case, though, they're treated with Wavane, which increases the contractility. In this case, they reach a steady state, and eventually they go to G, and then they come back to H, in which cardiac output and venous return are equal and about 5 liters per minute. So this has been compensated, in this case, pharmacologically. The body couldn't do it, but interventions allowed it to occur. Okay, any questions on that? No? Okay, so let's talk now about the etiology of the ischemia reperfusion injury. And we've got part of it right here. This is a major component of ischemia and ischemia reperfusion injury. And one of the first things that happens, I guess I need to draw this, is that we develop an osmotic overload. So this is the coronary blood flow here. The blood flow is coming in, and these cells, let's just put a couple of cells right here. These cells have undergone ischemia. As a consequence, they build up lactate. And they also reduce ATP, but they increase the metabolites of ATP, which include ADP, inorganic phosphate, AMP, adenosine, blah, blah, blah. What happens is here, in this situation, the total number of solutes in solution is greater than what existed before. The lactate has come from glycogen. Glycogen is one molecule. It's a polymer with many, many glucoses on it, and it's been converted into hundreds of lactate molecules. So we've increased the osmolarity of this particular cell. And normal osmolarity is 300 milliosmoles per liter, roughly, or osmolar, and the blood is 300 as it comes in. But what happens in this situation, the blood flow, we'll say, is completely blocked right here. And as it does so, this value may increase. Let's just arbitrarily say it goes up to 400, just for fun. So during the period of ischemia, the easiest example is to think of complete occlusion, but usually it's a partial occlusion. But in the extreme case, we have no flow here, and this is rising during the period of ischemia. And this is okay because the surrounding tissue also becomes 400 because the water will equilibrate across here and everything is, as they say in some part of the world, it's hunky-dory. But, what's that? Do you want to ask a question? No? Okay. So, things are fine during ischemia, but when reperfusion occurs and flow is reestablished, the blood is now coming in at 300 milliosmoles or milliosmolar. So, what's the problem here? What happens? You've done these experiments, right? In high school, you have red blood cells on a stage of a microscope. Have you done these things? Where were you guys in high school? Were you guys showing up? Or you don't do these things? You put on a drop of water on red blood cells, what happens? Say what? What do you guys do?
Nothing.
They burst. Why? Why does the water enter the cell? Right? Okay, and what's the principle that would cause water to move into the cell? Osmosis? Or another way of looking at it is simply diffusion of water moving from high concentration to low concentration, right? And that's what this is. So in this case, actually the water is in higher concentration in the blood than it is in the interstitium or in the cell, because the water has been diluted by more solutes. Or another way of saying it, the osmotic pressure is greater inside the cell than here, so we have a net movement of water in here. So this is something, and this, I have to emphasize this, this is something we see in the reperfusion phase, even though the scenario was created during ischemia. In ischemia, we don't see the swelling so much. It's when reperfusion is, or perfusion is reestablished, we see the swelling, and it can result in cell lysis, mitochondrial swelling, a whole bunch of things. Okay? Everyone understand that? So that's osmotic overload. The second thing is, I've alluded to this already, the immune response. And we know that when the heart undergoes an ischemic attack, neutrophils accumulate, the complement system, which I didn't really talk about, gets activated. And we also know that if you do these experiments, in the absence of neutrophils, the recovery is always much better. So like atherosclerosis, in which you could argue it's the immune system gone awry, or the immune system's been tricked into doing something that's not really beneficial because it sees signals which activate it, this is also the case. There's some damage that's occurring here. Neutrophils attack it, but the neutrophils are attacking itself and killing myocytes or potentially damaging myocytes because they release oxygen-free radicals, etc. The last one, and you could argue the most important, and you could also argue this list is by no means complete, because just like atherosclerosis, ischemia reperfusion injury is multifaceted, multifactorial, and I'm just presenting it in a couple of minutes here, and I'm simplifying it grossly. But this factor, this last factor, is very important. It's called the pH paradox. Now, I told you before, there's several paradoxes, and the pH paradox is one of those. This is the pH paradox. When the hearts become ischemic, they become acidotic. And how they become acidotic is pretty complicated. I'm sure that most of you are going to think lactate accumulates and therefore it's acidosis, but the story is not nearly as simple as that. Let's just say, though, as the hearts become ischemic, we increase the hydrogen ion concentration, which is related to lactate and a lot of other things, meaning decreased pH. Okay. So that's a given. All the hearts that become ischemic become acidotic. And the pH normally inside the cell is about 7.0, and it could drop to 6.6. Really serious, it could drop to 6.2. And remember, we're dealing with a logarithmic scale. So if it goes from 7 to 6, it's a tenfold increase in the hydrogen ion concentration. It's huge. So this is the paradox now. We have an acidosis. Now we reestablish blood flow. So we're using the same example as we did in the osmotic overload. We have a situation which we completely block blood flow to this part of the heart. We get acidosis here. When we reestablish blood flow, the pH that's coming in here is normal pH. The pH of the blood is about 7.35, depending whether it's arterial or venous, and a few other things. But the pH is higher than that of the cells. The seven cells are about 7.0, 7.1, something like that. So we come in here with new blood at the appropriate pH, the normal pH, and it allows for recovery of pH within the cell. And I'll talk about how the pH recovers in a minute. You might expect, your intuition might say that the faster we can get rid of the acidosis, the better the recovery will be. Because acidosis is not good. This acidosis is inhibiting the CIRCA, NCX, all the calcium transporters, all of the enzymes involved in metabolism. The reality is just the opposite. That's the paradox. The slower you recover from the acidosis after ischemia or during reperfusion, the better the recovery. So that's the pH paradox. If you can slow intracellular pH recovery, you improve the outcome, meaning you get less cell death, you get less hypocontractility, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So when the people first started doing these experiments, they were expecting to find what you would guess intuitively. If you can speed up recovery of acidosis during reperfusion, it's going to work better. And they were surprised, and of course they kept doing the experiments. They couldn't believe their own results. Now it's well established. pH paradox. How does this occur? Well, let me... I don't know whether I should... Maybe I should draw this. Okay. So the first thing is, we have this acidosis. And pH is regulated homeostatically in the heart cell, as it is in almost all cells of the body. The cells have to keep pH roughly constant, or else it becomes dysfunctional, because acidosis, as I just mentioned, inhibits all the metabolic and contractile machinery. So the acidosis creates a hypocontractile state. It's a negative inotropic agent. So if we have hydrogen ions that accumulate here, drop in pH, these are removed from the cell through several transporters, the most important of which is the sodium proton exchanger. Type 1. There's several different genes for this. It's called NHE sodium proton exchanger. That's what this is an acronym for. So they didn't use X, they used E. Different guys decided what these things were called. The people discovered them, and so that's why. And the sodium proton exchanger, the sodium hydrogen ion exchanger, works like this. It removes hydrogen ions and brings sodium into the cell. So it's an antiport, or an exchanger, and it's non-electrogenic, so it's a one-to-one stoichiometry. One hydrogen ion, one sodium. So it can actually remove hydrogen ion against the concentration gradient, because it can use a sodium electrochemical gradient, just like the sodium-calcium exchanger and a variety of other sodium-coupled transporters. Okay. So this can happen. We have this acidosis building up, and we start getting removal of the hydrogen ions. It's trying to bring pH closer to 7.0. At 7.0, this thing is not really removing hydrogen ions. At 6.5, it's working vigorously to remove them. Okay, so I think I've got that up here. Well, that's kind of weird. So it stimulates the sodium hydrogen ion exchanger. And then the next consequence of this is that it increases intracellular sodium. And the consequence of this is on the sodium-calcium exchanger, NCX, sitting right here. And NCX is normally taking calcium out of the cell, taking one calcium out and bringing three sodium in. But this intracellular accumulation of sodium is kind of screwing up this thing, and it's reducing the electrochemical gradient for sodium. So if the sodium is accumulating here, it does a couple of things. One is it can reduce the ability for calcium efflux. And the other is that eventually, if the sodium gets high enough, it can actually contribute to calcium influx. So it's changing the ability of the NCX to remove calcium. And the calcium overload, and I just mentioned it, this is a huge problem, because what calcium does, it activates troponin C at rest, activates these calpanes, et cetera, et cetera. And so this results in increased calcium with all the ramifications of this. Contracture, proteases, etc. And how do we know that? Well, we know that because there are drugs that block NHE. And when you apply these drugs, you get a really profound effect on the recovery rate. And these drugs are being tried out clinically right now. They have to be used under a certain set of circumstances. What I haven't talked about very much, because it's complicated, is when do these events occur? Removal of hydrogen, is it during ischemia, is it during reperfusion? I think if you give it some thought, you can figure out that most of this is going to occur during reperfusion, because during ischemia, even though the hydrogen ions are inside the cell and they're accumulating, as they're transported out, if there's no flow out here, hydrogen ions will accumulate outside and eventually this process will stop. But during reperfusion, we have fresh blood coming in, we remove the hydrogen ions from outside, then these things can really take off. So these events are occurring during ischemia, but during the reperfusion phase, they can become really serious. So I think I've got a quick summary here. Increased sodium, NCX, calcium overload, contractile dysfunction. Okay? This is pH paradox. A few pretty pictures just to see if you're awake. This is one person's view of what NHE looks like, but the structure isn't completely known. This has got about 10 transmembrane segments. It's got a hydrogen ion sensor on here. It's got a C-terminus domain that is subject to phosphorylation and other regulation. It's like NCX in a lot of ways, except that this thing right here in NCX was in the middle of the molecule. Here it's on the C-terminus end. Okay? So this thing is a very important transporter in the heart. It's functioning all the time. We're always producing hydrogen ions. It's keeping the pH constant. During ischemia, this thing really gets taxed. And then this is the relationship between NHE and N... This is crazy. It should be NCX, but this one guy who did this, he likes to call exchangers with E rather than X. This is NCX right here. This is the thing I just drew. And it also shows that one of the problems here, I didn't mention, I should have, one of the reasons that sodium is accumulating here is the sodium potassium pump is not really functional, as I mentioned on Wednesday, I think, because of lack of ATP and some membrane damage. So normally, this would be dealt with by the sodium-potassium pump. It's not dealt with effectively. Okay? Any questions on the pH paradox? All right. So, we've had an ischemic event, and the next series of slides are going to be how do we detect what's happened, the degree, the extent of the damage, where the damage is, etc., so that you can have intervention. Well, an obvious way is with an EKG. An EKG is non-invasive, it's cheap, readily available, and you can tell a lot of things from the EKG, but you can't tell everything, obviously. The first example I'm going to go through is subendocardial ischemia. We've talked about this before, and you're going to need a big picture of the left ventricular wall. And we have an area right here that's compromised. And this area is on the subendocardial side. So this is the endocardium right here. This is the subendocardium. This is the epicardium. So in other words, this is the lumen of the heart, this endo. And we have an electrode. Someone once asked me, what the hell was I drawing here? This is supposed to be an electrode that's stuck to your chest. Someone had drawn it a foot or something like that. It's not a foot that's staying on your chest. It's an electrode that's taped on. This is the heart. So this is could be the sternum, depending on which electrode, but the ribs and the fat tissue and the skin, and then this electrode is stuck on here, the recording electrode. Okay? So in subendocardial ischemia, what happens is that this area is ill-perfused. And as I mentioned before, two things happen. The subendocardium has a higher demand for oxygen, for reasons I really didn't talk about, and it's more likely to be compromised with atherosclerosis because the blood vessels are traversing through transmurally, through the wall. So for people with coronary artery disease doing a stress test, this is a very common site of ischemia. So these cells here are compromised. They're ischemic, and they're doing all these things we talked about. But one of the things we talked about is that potassium can accumulate outside because of activation of the ATP-dependent potassium channel. And these cells can become depolarized. So let's just talk, first of all, about diastole. And we'll say that the cells throughout the heart are sitting at minus 80 millivolts. Just for fun. I'm just using this as an example. Okay, it's not that much fun, but we'll use minus 80. This area right here has suffered ischemia for a period of time. The potassium has accumulated, and it means that EK has gone down, and it means that membrane potential has gone down. So this area has become, in fact, depolarized. And let's arbitrarily say it's sitting at minus 40 millivolts. Now, again, there's some issues here that may seem counterintuitive, but when it's sitting at minus 40 millivolts for a long period of time, it's actually in a hypoexcitable state, not a hyper. You think it's moved closer to threshold, but the fact is it's depolarized very slowly, and threshold is a moving point, and has to do with the relationship between the sodium channels that are inactive and the sodium channels that are available to become active. And when you depolarize slowly, you put more and more of the sodium channels in an inactive state, and they're maintained there. Okay, so what we have now, instead of homogeneity of the membrane potential across all parts of the heart during diastole, we actually have an electrical gradient. And positive charges will move towards the... positive charges will move to the area that's more negative. So from this injured area to the surrounding area. So a positive charge, because we're always using a positive charge as a reference for the EKG, will move in this direction. And this is called the injury current. Normally it wouldn't exist because there would not be an electrical gradient. There is because of this ill-perfused section of the heart. And what that means is the EKG, we have the current moving towards the electrode, it causes an upward shift in the EKG. And so, let's just put our EKG like this. This is diastole right here. When current's moving towards the electrode, it causes an upward shift, so our baseline is actually shifted upwards. Okay? So that's the situation during diastole. Now let's look at the situation during systole, or the peak of the action potential. Let's look at what happens here. So I just need to change a few things here. I'm going to change these arrows. And now this area is sitting at plus 20, or plus 10, we'll say the plateau is plus 10 millivolts. And that area, that ischemic area, is remaining at minus 40, because at minus 40 it became inexcitable and did not undergo an action potential. The sodium channel, there weren't enough sodium channels to recruit, or calcium channels to recruit, to get an action potential, so it remained at minus 40 and did nothing. In this particular situation, we have the reverse. We have an injury current in the opposite direction. Positive charge is moving to the more negative area, so this injury current is moving away from the electrode, causing a depression. This is during systole, so what it means is the ST segment gets reduced. So this is ST segment depression. And this is a classic EKG hallmark of subendocardial ischemia that you see on a stress test. And when someone stops, the baseline comes back up and the ST segment comes back up. Okay? I think I've got a terrible diagram which I hand drew, but this goes through it. So. Oh yeah, there's a J point right here, but we can talk about it. And this is my hand-drawn thing, which really is terrible. It reviews some of the concepts we talked about before. But. Okay, now the other scenario is the sub-epicardial ischemia or transmural ischemia. And this often is much more serious because it can affect the entire wall. Now, of course, coronary artery disease causing that can be very serious if it results in an inability to meet demand. But in this case, it's exposed by a stress test, and as soon as you stop exercising, things turn to normal. It's unmasking the disease. Now, in transmural ischemia, or subepicardial ischemia, when we'll say that the blood vessel's coming in here, and there's a clot here. And this area right here is affected most dramatically. Now the other area, the subendocardium, may be getting some blood supply from some collaterals, etc. This area on the subepicardial side is the most impacted. And now we can draw almost the exact opposite of what we drew before. And we'll use the same values. So this whole heart is sitting at minus 80. This is sitting at minus 40 during diastole. And so what that means is we get baseline depression. This is during diastole. Instead of elevation, depression. Because the injury current, whoops, is moving away from the recording electrode. And during systole, we get ST segment elevation. Okay? Now, the one thing, and this is not easy to explain, but when someone is having an MI or is showing this transmural ischemia that's very severe, one of the first things that happens is the T waves become heightened. As I said, the actual mechanism of that is not easy to explain, and they often invert, which is shown here, an inversion of the T wave. Now, there are ways in which T waves can become inverted. People with, they call it athletic heart syndrome. But when you show T-wave inversion and you've got chest pains, then people are assuming you're having a heart attack. You're having an acute MI. These are symptomatic of it. And the T-wave inversion is related to the fact that we described before why the T-wave is positive. And actually, if I can go back and look at my abysmal drawing, we talked about this in lecture. The T-wave is upward. Because even though repolarization is moving away from the electrode, the actual current direction is toward the electrode, making the T wave upwards. Now, when we have a damaged wall, we affect the repolarization direction. We get areas that don't repolarize, causing this T wave inversion and ST segment elevation that I just mentioned. And the other part, that as the MI progresses, so most of the things I've talked about here are due to an acute MI. But as the MI progresses, people start developing something that's called, has a different name. So we learn them as dirty Q waves. Some people in the boron text, they call them deep Q waves. Some people call them pathological Q waves. But what it is the Q component of the QRS complex, this is QRS, shows this kind of phenomenon. This is what the deep means, or the dirty, because it's masking the QRS complex. When this component, the Q component of the QRS, exceeds 30 milliseconds, it's usually indicative of some major damage. And the dirty Q wave remains a hallmark of a damaged heart. Even a year or 2 years after the heart attack, you'll still see dirty Q waves. The reason for it, this is the normal explanation. So here's the left and right ventricle. We see something like this, and we're recording from this part of the heart right here. If, in fact, this part has undergone an MI, and it's dead, so it's post-MI, this becomes electrically silent. The cells have no membrane potential. They're sitting at 0 millivolts, and they don't change. So it's an electrically silent area of the heart. And the electrode is actually picking up the signal from the opposite side of the heart, which is in the opposite direction of what you'd normally expect. So the Q wave gets this negativity associated with it. Now remember, again, it depends on which electrode we're looking at, but we're getting this because we have an area that's electrically silent, the area right underneath the electrode, because it's been scarred, because it's gone through all these things in the acute MI phase, and now it's picking up a signal from the opposite side that's moving, in which the electrical current is moving in the opposite direction because of its orientation. It's on the other side. Okay? So if you show up and you've got dirty Q waves, then they say, well, you've had some damage, and it looks like you had an MI, and they won't know when, and they might not know where, although the electrode load placement, like if you use the precordial limbs, leads, etc., you might be able to sort of get an idea. And this is a dirty Q wave right here. This is a huge one. And this is ST segment elevation. So these are the hallmarks, and T wave inversion. So those are the three things we talked about. And normally the T-wave inversion is the first, one of the first things to happen. ST segment elevation, and these are all, T-wave inversion occurs in the acute phase. This is occurring more later on and persists long after this MI has come and gone. Okay, now in addition to doing EKG, there are other ways to evaluate whether someone is having problems with an ischemic attack. One way is, especially if someone is showing T-wave inversion and they've got chest pains, you might want to corroborate it with something else. And one way is to look at plasma markers of MI. And this is creatine kinase, lactate dehydrogenase. We talked about these, and this is troponin I. And what this means is that after an MI, the cells become damaged to the point that they lose their integrity. And these large proteins can escape from the cell across the plasma membrane into the interstitium and maybe into the blood. Now, one of the problems that people had originally is that whenever someone ran a marathon, they'd see elevated CK levels. And the reason is that the skeletal muscles were losing CK because of the muscle damage from 2 to 4 hours of running. Now what people use are cardiac-specific isoforms of these. And each of these enzymes, sorry, these are two enzymes, this is a structural protein, each of these has a cardiac-specific isoform in which you can get antibodies or you can detect for it separately from the skeletal form. The problem with it is that there's a relatively narrow window and it's often too late. If someone's having an acute MI, these levels may not rise until the next day. And if you come in 3 days later, you may not see much. So it's a relatively short window, but TNI is now the reporter of choice, and it's set up with a monoclonal assay to measure TNI levels, the cardiac specific form. And one of the reasons for this is that I mentioned during calcium overload, proteases are activated. And when the proteases are activated, TNI is thought to be one of the targets. And TNI is released, the cell membrane is damaged, gets into the blood, and you can recognize it. So this, you can corroborate EKG, but this is not cutting-edge stuff, but it's simply a cheap way of seeing whether, in fact, if someone has T-wave inversions, are they having some other indicators of MI? But, of course, now people use much more sophisticated techniques, and radionuclide imaging is one of those. Echocardiography and MRI or others, these are much more expensive. And I can't go through all the details here, but in radionuclide imaging, people will inject radioactive tracers into the blood, sometimes thallium-201, sometimes technetium-99. This is a metastable isotope of technetium. Technetium-99 has a very long half-life, and it's a gamma emitter. You don't want to be doing this to the person, because even if they survive the heart attack, they'll die from radiation poisoning. So in this particular isotope that they use, the metastable has a half-life of about 6 hours. So they inject it, and as I said before, often they can inject it with another isotope. Now what's commonly used is the technetium is actually labeling this molecule MIBI. And MIBI gets into the heart cells, the living heart cells, and you can see when cells are alive, because if you put a gamma camera on the heart, you can see where the technetium is in the heart. You can actually map it out, because it's a gamma emitter, strong emission, but short-lived, and wherever the technetium is, the MIBI is, and wherever the MIBI is, it means we have functioning cells. It won't go into dead cells, and it won't get to cells if the blood flow is screwed up. So this bottom line here tells you one of the problems. If MIBI doesn't show up, doesn't go into the cells, there's one of two things. Either there's an MI because the cells are dead, or the coronary blood flow is compromised, like you'd see. Now you can discern between these two by using double isotopes, another isotope that will be transported in the blood but not necessarily go into the cells, and you can check to see whether it's ill-perfused or whether the heart cells are actually dead, and you can separate those. And I think I've got a very quick image here of this is a MIBI scan, I believe, and this is during exercise, and you can see the compromise right here. This is a defect, and when they stop, we get an improvement. So we have some sort of ischemic disease right here, etc. I'm really running out of time. All right. So what do we do about these things? Treating people after they have an MI is not the way to go, obviously. We want to do prevention. And so prevention involves almost everything we've talked about in this course. You want to prevent hypertension. You want to prevent diabetes. You want to prevent high lipidemia, high LDLs, low LDLs, blah, blah, blah. Prevention is important. You want to use whatever tools you can to intervene to stop the progress of atherosclerosis and hypertension and all these things. But something that's come out in the last few years, the last 10 years, is actually the result of another paradox. And this paradox is called ischemic preconditioning. And what it is when these guys did it about 12 years ago, I guess, what they thought was, if they gave the heart very brief periods of ischemia, so these are ischemic bouts right here, and they're about 5 minutes long, and it could be total, it doesn't really matter, then you give the heart, you know, a long-term ischemia that it might see. It's called the index ischemia, but it doesn't matter. This could be 30 minutes long. What they were expecting is that these brief bouts of ischemia prior to the main bout would actually exacerbate the damage or reduce the recovery that we see. But in fact, and the paradoxical component is that these brief bouts of ischemia improve the recovery. And this is called ischemic preconditioning. These bouts of ischemia set up some cascade, some signaling cascade in the heart, which we know some details about, but I don't have time to talk about. We talk about it in 412 if you're interested. These set up a signaling cascade that actually are cardioprotective, so that during the main bout of ischemia, less damage is done. Now, I had mentioned a long time ago that with the phospholipase 2, we generate diacylglycerol, or DHG, and I said I'd talk about it later, because IP3 is the main signal, because it causes calcium release. But DHG is involved in this pathway by promoting protein kinase C, a specific isoform. So we talked about PKA and PKG. This is PKC. To date, we know about 11 different isoforms of PKC. One particular one, the epsilon version of this thing, is thought to be activated during the bouts of ischemic preconditioning. And then it institutes some changes, which are still being debated, in the myocardium that are cardioprotective. But some of these things include, the activation includes increase in GK of the ATP-dependent potassium channel. But not just in the sarcolemma, the one we talked about, but also in the mitochondria. What does this all mean? Well, obviously, you can't use this as a tool as it is. You can't say, well, it looks like you're going to have a heart attack, so we're going to give you a few brief heart attacks before your big one. And, you know, you might come out better. On the other hand, who knows? So get your insurance. So that's not going to happen. However, the cascade that's set up by the preconditioning bouts is now being understood. So the possibility is that pharmacologically, and we know some agents like adenosine and other ones, if you give them here, it activates the cascade as if it were seeing preconditioning, and it becomes cardioprotective. Now, experimentally, we can do this. We know how to do this. It's a question of applying this, nature's design, to protect itself, to protect the heart, and prevent the damage that occurs during an MI. Okay, that's it for my section. And on Wednesday, Mike starts, and once again, Monday is a holiday. It's an official 305 holiday. Okay?